Welcome to the Iron Basketball Podcast, the Pick and Troll Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. Matt Moore, happy Canada Day.
I'm from there, so...
Well, actually, it's probably not Canada Day, right? When is Canada Day? Do we know
this? It's whenever we tell them it is.
Oh!
It's whenever we tell
them. Flexing our American muscles.
It's whenever we allow them to have... Just kidding, Canada, you seem very nice. I hope to visit you someday. Not in February, hopefully.
But... Yeah, that's the thing. Someone asked me the other day, like, oh, where's the All-Star game next season? I said, oh, it's in Toronto. I'm like, oh, cool. Have you ever been? I was like, no, but I really wanted to go not in February. I'm very interested in the idea of visiting Toronto, but not in February. Especially, like, New York was just such a disaster because it was so cold.
It was cold and...
And
splitting it between there and Brooklyn. And,
right, yeah. It was just a disaster. Like, it was a really good idea, but... The conditions just didn't make it very very easy to navigate. But I'm sure, I don't know how far the north it is, 6 hours north, I'm sure it'll be even colder and windier.
When James was there, like I showed up and we met for coffee and I was wearing, you know, every piece of clothing I own. and James is like walking around like a windbreaker.
Right.
And I was like, gosh, it's so hot here. There was a while when James was not wearing a coat, and I was like, what are you?
Yeah, what is wrong with you?
What mutant version? And that's what's crazy, because people were like, well, you live in Denver. And I was like, yeah, like Denver, where it snows for like 4 days, like it's the end of the world. Like it's the day after tomorrow. And then basically in 35 minutes, it's all gone.
Right.
And then the rest of the time, it's basically pretty mild here. It's between 40 and 50 in the winter. Not so much in New York when you're walking from Times Square, which, by the way, that was the thing, is like staying at the media hotel was a mistake because I was like, why am I staying in Times Square? Why am I doing that? Like, I'm in New York. Why am I in Times Square?
There's a spot near Times Square, but it's not like directly in Times Square, which is the spot I love. It's this place called Row NYC. Really nice hotel. Close enough to everything. It's right in that area, but it's not in the thick of it.
Right.
And so that's where I stayed. And even that, I was just like, it's convenient, but it's not that convenient. So I can't imagine, like Times Square, I just imagine it's like that Seinfeld episode with the Kenny Rogers roaster chicken, where it's just this bright red light in your window at all times.
When we have our annual meeting coming up for our little CBS Sports NBA group, and when they say, okay, who wants to go to All-Star? You and I need to do the thing from the comedy movies where you and I both step back. On it! Glad you're going.
Guys, I really, you know, I just want to give someone else the opportunity this year.
You're not going to be leaping over each other to be trying to look gracious. Like, I've been so many times, and I just want to help the young guys out and give them a boost.
But if
like
you guys
Kent Berger, the young guy.
Yeah, a young upcoming guy like Kent Berger can go to the All-Star Weekend. By the way, if you guys need me to go to Santa Clara for Super Bowl 50, I'm willing to make that sacrifice.
I'll take one for the team there.
Yeah, I'll take one for the team there. Just to button up this topic of weather, I had my first like real kind of hurricane experience in Miami, where that for like 5 days people freaked me out with like, all right, maybe you should go buy some water and some batteries and a flashlight, and you know, it's not a hurricane, but it's a tropical storm. It'll, you know, might blah blah blah, and then it was supposed to hit yesterday. And just beautiful. Just not a cloud in the sky yesterday. Very sunny. Wind worked out outside. It was hot. It didn't hit here. And it like kind of dissipated, I think, by the time it hit. I think it hit closer to like the Caribbean, like maybe Dominican Republic area. Like I think it hit decently there. But here it was just like for 5 days. It was all this like... all right, you don't have to freak out, but you should be prepared in case the power goes out. And I think we were making plans at the office and all this stuff about, like, where people are going to be. And that, yeah, nothing. Just beautiful day on Monday. And it's beautiful today, and I think it's maybe will rain at the end of the week.
Yeah, that one did not live up to the hype. Although, like, I would stay humble. This would be my
advice.
There were, like, 7 hurricanes in the Pacific at once or something ridiculous the other day. And then...
Yeah.
The El Nino thing is going to get trumped up, but for like where I live, it's like, no, man, like in October, like I've seen it snow. And so like if you increase just even a little bit of the amount of precipitation here, it's really going to be like a blizzard in October. Like,
yeah.
I already told the wife, I was like, I'm buying salt tomorrow. She cracked me up too because I said that. She was like, oh, so Rockets fans are talking to you again.
Oh no.
And I was like, oh,
throwing jabs. The whole Moore family.
I didn't like the terminology, but that was well done.
Hey, speaking of, so you got something up or coming up on the Houston Rockets, and it's a very interesting topic because, especially like surrounding the Chandler Parsons fiasco. Well, I don't know if fiasco's the right thing, but it was, you know, they're going to value him. They're going to match whatever because it's a small cap hold and they can make it work and they'll go get someone to, you know, they'll bring in a free agent and then they'll match Chandler Parsons' offer sheet and then they'll have this, you know, really kind of deep starting lineup of sorts in terms of star power or at least like versatility. And then they didn't. And then Chandler Parsons kind of had these comments about Daryl Morey and it's been this idea that like Daryl Morey kind of treats this like a fantasy team. And that he's just trying to get assets. He's just trying to get players. There's no real relationship building with each player. They kind of feel like commodities instead of people. But maybe that's not the case anymore.
Yeah, and I likened it to they say the same things about Hinkie, right? In Philly, which is Hinkie's from the Houston tree, so it makes sense that they don't regard players as people. They just regard them as assets, and the idea of these human beings as commodity is really troublesome depending on how far you take it. Like it's just an unsettling concept when you start thinking, because we talk about it in those terms, but when you start to really think about it within the framework of those concepts, it gets very concerning. And even if you don't take it so far into like a socio-political kind of concept,
right,
it's still just, it's unnerving for players because they're like, we're people, we have families, we have lives, I have feelings, like I want to be treated like an employee and not a resource. And my point was, it was built off of something I read on Red 94 the other day, great Rockets blog, talking about the Jason Terry signing. And the point was basically, everyone talks about how Morey never values people and doesn't value chemistry, and it's he's got no regard for the human connection. It's all about the metrics. Well, there's no real reason to bring Jason Terry at age 38 back, except for he was a great locker room leader. And now they really retain, you know, they retain Corey Brewer this summer. They didn't bring back Josh Smith, but I think you can kind of look at that and say it was, you know, wasn't the best situation for him, and they wanted to make room for Lawson and all these things. So Morey has kind of shifted now to where, because I was actually a little bit surprised early on. I thought Morey would be more aggressive in making upgrades, and instead they basically brought back the same team and then added Lawson, and that's, you know, and obviously Decker and Harrell, like they basically brought back the same team, and that was kind of interesting from the perspective of that builds continuity, and they didn't necessarily pursue those individual improvements.
Right.
Now they still can do that. Like I think there's a chance if Mody Ekwunis has another, if he starts off the year great, like, if he just picks up where he left off, I think they're probably going to look at Terrence Jones and be like, can we get good value for this? Can we get, is there an area where we can find something else, like a shooter particularly is kind of what they need. Can we add another shooter by moving Terrence Jones? And if they can do that, I think they'll still pursue that. So it's balancing both, but Morey's simply no longer in, got to get more assets, got to take advantage. I think he looks at it and says, even though I didn't get necessarily three superstars, I got two, but I didn't get three superstars. I got Harden, I got Howard, and now I added Lawson, who a couple of years ago would have been regarded as a true star. Like Ty Lawson has been statistically one of the best offensive point guards in the league over the last 3-4 years.
Yeah, he's been, I mean, he's a borderline all-star.
Yeah.
Every year.
And so you can look at that and say, all right, that's like the framework, and now, and obviously I think with last year's success, because I always get nervous when guys buy too much into last year's success, and I still have a little bit of that concern with Houston. That's one of the reasons that I think Houston is so fun to talk about, because on the surface, this makes complete sense, right? They won the number 2 seed in the brutal Western Conference despite missing Dwight Howard for most of the year. They made it to the Western Conference Finals and faced the Warriors, and honestly were in it very much in the first two games, and had either of those games gone their way, the series probably plays out at least a little bit differently. It probably shifts a little bit, even though I think everyone would probably agree the Warriors would still win because of their matchup advantages. there's still, like, that's on the surface, that's such a tremendous year. It's like, well, of course they're bringing everybody back. But when you get into the kind of context, which is, to me, they weren't the second best team in the conference last year. That was Memphis, and Memphis just happened to hit a slide and get injured late in the year with Tony Allen and Mike Conley at the wrong time. You could say, well, Dwight Howard. I was like, well, yeah, but we also don't know if Dwight Howard was healthy, if the Rockets would have won so many games. The injury things are really complicated. Like, it's a really complicated dynamic to kind of unfurl, and you and I have talked about this a lot. I feel like Memphis overall was the second-best team in the conference, and then you look at it in the second round, the Rockets should have lost that series. Like, you play that series out 99 times out of 100, or you play that series 100 times, the Rockets are probably winning, like, 40 to 50 times, but I would say that the Clippers are probably winning a majority of the time after going up 3-1. It's simply unlikely that it would have played out the way that it did. So the context behind it is very interesting, both from a good perspective and bad. Like, I like that Morey is building this continuity. I like that he's kind of going in. And after looking at the roster really hard yesterday, I'm like, holy crap, this team is stacked. But it does represent a real shift in who they are and who they've been.
Well, yeah, and I think that part of that is – so what Morey took over in, like, what, 2007, 2008? Like, kind of the end of that – or I guess, like, really the beginning of the end of that Tracy McGrady, Yao Ming stuff, right? And so, and he lost out on his two stars because of injuries. Like, nothing really you can control, as far as we know. And so he takes over a team that should be poised, like, oh, you can really build around these two, to, oh, crap, we've got to transition to a new thing. And so when you transition, when you start rebuilding or retooling or however you want to brand it, it gets into the, all right, well, we need assets. Like, you need assets to make trades. You need assets to convince signings that that's the place to go. Like, you need to acquire as much as you can, especially when, you know, historically, like, Houston probably not necessarily, like, the most attractive free agent city, or maybe they just didn't have opportunities when big free agents came up. Like, who's the last guy they got? Like, did they... I can't remember if they traded for Barkley or if they signed him, or if they traded for Pippen, or if they signed him outright. But, like, you can go get guys, but to get players to just outright sign with you is difficult, especially when you don't have much in the cupboard, right? And so they have to get assets. They have to show that, yes, we're a big market city who should be treated as a big market when it comes to free agent destination, all this stuff. And then they finally get that guy. They finally get James Harden. And then they get Dwight Howard to sign with them. And all of a sudden it's like, all right, see, we are a major player in this league. But there's a certain point where we have to transition from we're trying to acquire, to we're trying to build a team. Like, there's a huge difference between acquiring players and building a team. And this shows more of the team building. And really the team building is when, or at least the team shaping is when you start bringing in, like, all right, we've got our core. We've got these guys who need mentorship on the side. We've got the role players we want. Now we need the veterans or the presence or whatever to kind of get everyone on the same page. And Jason Terry is, like, one of those guys, right? Like, I mean, with the Dallas Mavericks, he'd been just an incredible influence both on and off the court. Well, he's not really a great influence on the court anymore because he can't do those things so much. He can have little brief flashes, but... remember for 2 years I was saying he was a zombie on the court, and even that would, like, seem like it was being generous. Like, he just wasn't any good. Well, now you overly simplify his role to where he doesn't really have to do anything but hit spot-up jumpers, and he gets to provide the leadership, you know, on the bench, in the locker room, all in practice, all that stuff, and get everyone mentally ready to be a title contender. And that's the key. Like, you can get all that talent, you can get the coaching, you can get whatever you want on the team, but you have to then figure out how to mentally take that next step. And these are the types of moves, the ones you're talking about, these are the types of moves that really get you to that next step. And it is tricky with them because, this stuff's just never in a vacuum. Right, like you can't just say, oh, well, if Dwight had played the whole season, then imagine where they'd be. It doesn't work like that because different motivations come up, different scenarios come up with in-game stuff. Like, you don't just automatically get to win more games. They could have had the exact same record with a healthy Dwight Howard all season long and looked like a completely different team throughout. And James Harden doesn't have to learn so much or do so much as that lead guy. Or maybe he's not an MVP candidate because Dwight Howard shoulders more of the load. You know, it's like little stuff like that can change. And I think you just get to a point where there's too much randomness, and too many, like, sliding door scenarios where you can't say, like, oh, well, if this guy's healthy, like, that's why I can't stand the whole, like, Cavs versus Warriors finals if the Cavs are healthy. It's because they don't play the same way. They don't play, you know, they don't slow the game down. They don't become that defensive unit without, you know, without their main guys. And so you don't know how that plays out. Like, you can guess that it would have been, maybe they have a higher chance of winning the series, but I don't think, you know, I don't think they're, you can just blindly say, like, oh yeah, they win that series against, you know, if they're healthy against the Warriors, because it's just a different series. So the same thing applies to the Rockets. I don't think they're necessarily the two seed if Dwight Howard is healthy the whole year.
And I read a lot about that Cavs series, that dynamic with Love and Irving.
Yeah.
Talked about, like, Kyrie impressed me so much in game one. I was like, Kyrie probably would have helped from the perspective of he had done such a good job on chasing Curry, and he was such an offensive counter. Like, he was playing Curry to a standstill, because that's kind of one of the really quiet things is Curry was good in the finals. I wouldn't say he had a bad series. Like, I would say Klay Thompson had a pretty bad series. But he wasn't great. That's why he didn't win MVP.
Right.
And so if Kyrie could have played him to a standstill, that really helps. But on the other hand, I'm like, if Love plays in that series, the Warriors, it would be really awkward, because it would be like, oh, Love gets torched again defensively. And, like, the Warriors would just have to stop themselves from being like, that's why David's over here on the bench.
Sorry, they put David Lee in, like, a disguise, so they don't get clued in or anything.
Right.
Like, I think you could make the argument, like, well, yeah, but the offense that the Cavs could put up, and I think that's true. Like, I think they could, but, you know, you got to have a balance, and we don't know that the Cavs had the right balance to beat the Warriors in a 7-game series, right?
I'm always baffled by that argument, because you and I would consider to be, to a degree, kind of trope busters, in that if there's something that people just say and it's not actually accurate, we'll sniff it out and we'll be pretty adamant about trying to prove in our writing this is not the case.
Right.
The playoffs really are a grinded out defensive game. Like, the Warriors played with pace, and that's still true, and it has evolved to be much more of a 3-point battle. But you have still got, like, defense has to come first. It has to come first. I just don't believe, I haven't seen a team simply overwhelmed with offense.
Right. I mean,
I haven't seen it.
And it's kind of the thing of, like, your defense, it's not that defense wins championships, it's that defense sets up your offense. Like, yeah, those little 8-0 runs in a second quarter throughout a series can decide the series. You know, obviously there's more context and stuff that goes into it, but I've just never liked the blind, like, vacuum thing. And it's like talking about draft picks, right? Like, oh, well, they passed up on this guy, and then they could have had this guy the next year. It's like, well, no. If they draft this guy that you wanted them to draft, they don't necessarily get the next pick in the next situation next year, you know? And they don't necessarily try to build the same team. Like, it's just, there's all these, like, butterfly effects. Like, what I'm saying is Ashton Kutcher rules the NBA. That's what happens, and you can't. And eventually, like, it doesn't matter.
I like that movie way more than I should.
Yeah, it's not really a good movie, but it's interesting.
The conceit is really interesting.
Yeah, the conceit's really interesting.
All right, so this is like a good example of kind of Maury. I'm looking at his basketball reference page,
mm-hmm,
which is hilarious, I might add.
There's like a lot of like 3 and 4 team deals, right?
I miss Mike Harris. By the way, missed Mike Harris.
Mike Harris is great.
So here's a crazy one. I forgot that they drafted Batum.
Oh.
They drafted Batum with the 25th pick and traded him to the Blazers in a 3-team deal. The Grizzlies traded Dante Green and a 2009 second. Sam Young was later selected to the Rockets. The Blazers traded Joey Dorsey to the Houston Rockets. And the Blazers traded Darrell Arthur to the Grizzlies. So they traded Nicholas Batum and Darrell Arthur and got Dante Green, Sam Young, and Joey Dorsey.
And then they flipped Dante Green after a 40-point summer league game for Ron Artest.
Yeah, and they traded him for Ron Artest. And then later on, like way down the line, right, they also made the move of – they traded Rafer to the Magic and got Kyle Lowry back from the Grizzlies.
Yeah.
That's how they got Lowry. And then later, this is the killer. Okay, so remember they drafted Joey, or they traded for Joey Dorsey, right?
Yeah.
that helped them on February 18, 2010, do the three-team deal with the Knicks, in which they sent McGrady to the Knicks, got the first-round draft pick, which they later took on Royce White, by the way. Whoops. but in that same deal, they picked up Kevin Martin from the Kings.
Yeah.
And they used Kevin Martin to trade for James Harden. Like, this was his whole MO. And this is what people lost, is like, Morey would do these deals that had great upside, but also it was like they would have so many unforeseen future effects. And it wasn't like the plan the whole time.
Right.
It was just that he always put himself in that position. But like that Royce White pick is a good example of this. And I've talked about this with the Celtics too. We give these teams. I'm starting to think, and I've done this a lot, that we give teams too much credit for picking up draft picks because they're really valuable. But I'm also like, I keep coming back to this, and again, Terry. Let's say if there is a proportional effect to the amount of crap that I have given the Celtics for Terry Rozier to how good Terry Rozier will be, Terry Rozier is going to be an MVP. But I cannot get over that they use a pick on him that high.
Right.
But that's like the thing, right? Is Ainge picked up all these picks, and you look at what they actually got. It's like they got Terry Rozier and RJ Hunter, and you're like, oh, that's like. That's not what I was expecting. That's not the windfall. And, you know, it's like, they got the Knicks first round pick. Well, they got Royce White out of it, you know?
Yeah, one, if you were to make a flow chart out of how players got to Houston through Daryl Morey's pit, like, I don't think Laura Croft could figure that one out. Like, that's a crazy kind of maze that you just can't get through. And if someone wants to do that, I would love you for that. Getting picks are valuable because, well, getting picks are a good thing. Like, we can't just kind of like go the other way on it and dismiss it. But at the same time, like, picks are only as valuable as you make them, right? I mean, especially like the idea of a protected pick can be such a tricky area, You can be like, oh, well, they're not getting it for 6 years, but in the seventh year, you know, it's unprotected, so anything could happen. And as long as you're not, like, hanging on that pick constantly, like, it can be valuable, but you're also putting an asset off for years.
Yeah.
And especially now, like, we've gotten to the point where pick protection becomes like, oh, yeah, it's a lottery protected for 4 years, and then if it doesn't get conveyed after that, becomes 2 second-round picks. And those second-round picks can be very valuable, but even those are, like, overvalued to a degree now. Like, it's just such a tricky gray area where, like, yeah, you want the picks, you want the asset because you can make it valuable, but it doesn't automatically have value. And so I think that's an important kind of thing that Morey really figured out, and or at least had figured out for a while as he was trying to acquire these assets, is, yeah, you take that pick and then you move this guy that you get with it and then you move that guy. And I was kind of likened it to, I think it was either Live 96 or Live 97. You could play out one season and you can make trades during it. And so my friend and I would always like, all right, you take this team, I'll take this team. And we would spend like the first 2 hours trading, like, all right, I'm going to trade Bobby Hurley for Sean Bradley and then Sean Bradley can give me this. Like, you're always trying to trade one rating up. Right, yeah. And then eventually you'd end up with a team of all stars, but you had to like figure out what those combinations like. That's what Morey kind of seemed like he was doing for a while. It was like he's trading a 70 rating for a 72 rating, then 72 rating for a 74 rating, 74 rating for a 78 rating. Like you could kind of make it work to that point, but you have to keep that kind of movement going. And so it's weird. Like with Morey too. Like I kind of felt like he got more credit than he deserved because every trade we'd be like, oh, there goes Daryl Morey again. And looking back, like it's not totally justified. But at the same time, if this is the team he's ended up with over an 8-year period of making all these moves, like maybe it is kind of justified. Like, I don't know. There's a weird balance of credit there.
I'd forgotten this. I'd forgotten that they drafted Mirotić.
Yeah.
And they traded Brad Miller, Mirotić, and Parsons, and a 2013 first-round pick, which became Andre Roberson, to the Wolves for Johnny Flynn, flashback, Modia Hunis, and a second-round pick, which became Will Barton.
And then they end up getting Chandler Parsons back like that
for
night.
For cash!
Yeah!
Like the same night, they just like swapped him, and then we're like, "We'll give you the money."
All right, let me get that back.
It was a very confusing night for Chandler.
I believe that was also the night David Kahn was accused of selling all these picks, selling draft picks and second round picks to pay for Kurt Rambis's salary.
Yeah,
because they just fired him, and then on media day the next season, Jerry Zagoda of the Star Tribune kind of asked him, like, you know, people think that you did this. To pay for, you know, the money, you know, help ease the pain of the bill you still have for Kurt Rambis' salary. And David Kahn swore on his kid's life that that was not the case, which really was like an unsettling feeling in the room.
That's a strong
thing. That was my first Wolves media day where I was like, oh, is this what it's going to be like?
Well, here's what's, and this is what's crazy. He traded Flynn, the beat, and the second round pick, which would become later become Barton, to the Blazers for Camby. They got Camby out of that deal. And then in 2012, so he signs Dalembert in 2011, like on December 24th, like just picks up Dalembert, right? In June of 2012, he trades Dalembert and a first round pick, which became John Henson, to the Bucks for Brockman, Luer, and Sean Livingston, neither of which would stay with the team, but also a 2012 first round pick, which became Jeremy Lamb.
Also in that Harden deal.
Who got included in that Harden deal. Like, I'm going to write a book on just looking at the moves that Morey did in order to create that deal.
Like, seriously, I don't think it's crazy. I don't think it's crazy. Maybe people, I'm sure there are some fans that will disagree, especially like Clippers and Warriors fans. But like, if the Rockets win a championship this year, there's a fascinating article or book, I guess, to be written about the process of building that team.
Yeah.
There's a lot that's got into it.
Yeah, man. Just so many crazy, crazy deals.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. I just went down this rabbit hole looking at Maury's transaction thing. Yeah. Nuts. I still can't believe. I really hope Isaiah Cannon gets a shot this year. The Sixers.
Yeah, I was looking at some stuff the other day, and like he was actually, I remember him being a disappointment last year, but like his numbers are kind of not bad. He just didn't run the team well, and I think that can just be an experience thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think his long-term prospects are good.
Yeah, and maybe I'm just caping for him because I really like him. I, you know, he's a dead-eye shooter, and I like dead-eyed shooters. But it, I don't know. It was like I was going back over stuff, and it wasn't as like he just couldn't hit. I think around the basket. Like I think that's what it was. And you look at that, and you're like, well, if you can't hit around the basket, what are you doing? But he's still a good three-point shooter for Philly. So I don't know.
I always think, though, that like finishing at the rim is not something I don't think that does come naturally. I think it's great when it does, but I think especially for small guards, that's something that you have to learn.
Yeah, certainly, and it's something where I always like this quote from Earl Boykins, where I think it was after one of his big breakout games when he kept getting shots and finally like got on the court, and I think a sideline reporter or maybe someone in a locker room afterwards, they were like, you know, how do you play against these big guys? You're only 5'5". And he's like, they've been bigger than me my whole life. Like, this is just how I've been forced to play. Now, when you're 5'11", 6 feet, they're still bigger than you, but it's not this astronomical difference. But I think there is a learning of the speed of the game. And it's not so much physicality, but it's knowing that guys can rotate over quicker and you have to adjust your finishing around the hoop. And I think Brandon Jennings had that problem for a while. Where it's been, I think it's kind of been corrected. Well, it was before the Achilles injury, but where like Brandon Jennings used to kind of be a disaster around the rim, and then he kind of, you know, he's not great, but he figured out more of a balance for it.
So there's the illustrious history of what Daryl Morey's done with his organization, and how sometimes the Rockets get too much hype for what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other end of the spectrum, we return to one of your favorite topics that you've discussed ad nauseum, including last week with James, the Sacramento Kings.
Yeah.
You gotta be sick of talking about them by now.
I definitely am.
Here's the thing. Yes, I am.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I talked about them with James, and we were kind of over talking about them, and then we got off the podcast. I was like, oh, there's actually an article I want to write about them. Like, I can't get them out of my head. It's driving me crazy.
So you wrote an article on Cousins and Carl, and it'll be up this afternoon, so I have not read it yet. Do you want to give me the gist?
Yeah, it's kind of looking at, like, how does George Karl turn the Kings into an elite offense? They jump during season, and there's randomness in this because it was so chaotic, but when Karl took over, they were the 19th offense in the NBA. And the last 30 games of the season, which were coached by Karl, they were 12th, which is a kind of a significant jump, but it could just be random. And it's, I kind of likened it to the year. What I tried to figure out was, like, can you build this fast-paced offense that is highly efficient, like he had in Denver, around DeMarcus Cousins? And kind of my thinking there was, like, all right, well, he did it with Carmelo Anthony, and Carmelo Anthony and DeMarcus Cousins are very different players, but they're still high volume guys that kind of just shoot from the similar spots on the floor. Cousins obviously much more around the basket, but he uses, like, kind of that left elbow around the free throw line a lot, and Carmelo Anthony used, like, that right wing elbow a lot inside the three-point line in the 2010-2011 season right before he got dealt. And that's the funny thing to me about this whole, like, oh, Denver got so much better without Carmelo once they traded him. That's kind of true. I mean, they were also a deeper team. But they, when they traded him, they had the number one offense in the league. Like, that, there was all this thing of, like, oh, Carmelo kills him, he's a ball stopper, all this stuff. They still had the number one offense when they dealt him. And so it's trying to figure out, can you build that elite offense around Cousins the way he kind of built it around Carmelo before he got traded? And I really think you can. I think the Cousins thing is, you know, the way you use him, the way you attack in the half court is similar to the way Carmelo did. It's getting everyone else around him to buy in. And so that's kind of like the where we get to in the article. It's like, can, you know, Chauncey Billups and Ty Lawson were the point guard combination. Can Darren Collison and Rajon Rondo replicate? And this is before Ty Lawson was, like, really Ty Lawson. So, like, it's not really that crazy to think, like, they can replicate those numbers. Can Marco Bellinelli be a lower volume but a more reliable J.R. Smith in those teams? Can Kostas Kupos and Willie Cauley-Stein give you what Kenyon Martin and Chris Anderson gave to those teams? Can Rudy Gay be what, like, Al Harrington, Nene were for those teams? Like, there's all these little, like, combinations where you look at what those productions were individually, and you look at the productions what the Kings had under Karl, and, like, there's a lot of similarities. And so you can look at that and say, well, yeah, even if they do that, though, they're a first round and out team, or maybe they get to the second round or whatever, but isn't that so much better than winning 28 games a year and being chaotic? Like, I just think, like, you have to get to that baseline. And so I think it's, doing it this season, maybe that's unreasonable. Doing it in the next two seasons, like, I do think there's a real, there's a real likelihood that Karl can get this Kings team to be that elite offense in the league.
Yeah, I'm reading over in our special blog tool right now, and it's really interesting stuff. One of my big takeaways from this is, one, his points per possession, like Cousins' points per possession under Karl in the post, 0.774. That's stunning.
It was really bad, and I watched as much of the video as I could, and it really just looked like, like, it looked like Cousins was gassed. And I chalked that up to the viral meningitis early in the year, because he was talking months after that. He was talking about it at the All-Star break. I'm like, I haven't really gotten my wind back. I haven't gotten my conditioning back. And I do think, like, it was so good before and it was so bad as the season went along. I kind of just chalked that up to randomness. But maybe that's me being naive. I don't know.
Here's I look at Melo, too. It's funny. We talk about kind of the stubborn. You talked about this, like, the stubbornness on both sides.
Yeah.
Right. And that comes down to, like, a philosophical thing, but it's also a basketball standpoint. In that, I honestly believe this. I think if you asked George Karl, and you said, "Could you win an NBA title if every player bought in and did what you asked them to do, and only what you asked them to do?" I think his real answer would be yes.
Yeah,
I think that's his biggest issue, is that he can't because he knows how good Melo is. And at the end, I think he very much wanted Melo gone, but the reason he wanted it to is because Melo would simply never accept. Like, I mean, look at the numbers that you got in this post. Like, 37% of Melo's time came in isolation.
Yeah,
that is a massive amount of time for George Karl offense, for the best player and the guy with the most possessions on a George Karl offense. people tend to think, oh, it's George Karl, it's run up and down, so there's no post action. And that's not the case.
What's funny is Cousins only played 19 of those 30 games under Karl. Yeah. He had a higher percentage of transition opportunities than Carmelo did in those 50 games under Karl that season. Like, he, I think Cousins had 11% of his possessions were transition, and I think Carmelo was like 9.5%. Like, it's weird that that Cousins ran more than Carmelo, at least in that small sample size.
Yeah, so there's like a huge capabilities. Also, like, the Nuggets never ran any sort of pick and roll with Melo as a screener.
Ever.
Anyway, but that's the thing. And I think on the other hand, I think if you ask Cousins, like, okay, well, if we just give you whatever you want, can you win? I think his answer would be, yeah. Like, you just let me do my thing. Like, empower me. And because all players say that. And Melo had the same thing in New York. Like, that's what he wanted. In New York, that's what he wanted was – and that's what Mike Brown – not Mike Brown.
Mike Woodson.
Mike Woodson gave him. You know, D'Antoni wanted him to run the system, and they clashed. And Melo was like, just let me do what I do. And then they went to Mike Woodson, and that one year it worked great. But in the playoffs it didn't, and over time, obviously, it didn't. Like, that's the thing is – Melo has never really figured out that, and this is like a really hard thing to figure to actually, I think, kind of suss out, right? LeBron, you do need to empower. Like, you want to put him in a position where he gets to make the right decision. Like, he gets to make the decision whenever, because LeBron almost always makes the right decision. I feel like Melo very much needs to be in a system where he subscribes to it, which he honestly I don't think ever has.
Well, it's hard to compare the two because they're just so different, but isn't that why he's so incredible in international play? Because you say, just go run up and down the floor and shoot the ball. And he's like, all right, I can do that. Like, don't, like, not hold the ball. But, like, just go, like, as soon as you get it, shoot it. And he's such a talented player that it's, now you can't create that necessarily in the NBA, but that's kind of the idea of melding what he does to what George Karl did or what Mike D'Antoni wanted him to do or whatever. It's like you can be the high-volume scorer, like, just do it in this fashion. And he's kind of like, I want to jab step. I want to pick my spots. I want to bully the other guy. Like, and it's this weird – and it's this stubbornness that just prevents the maximization of that potential.
I really want to watch a Team USA game next summer with George Karl.
That would be great.
And see how he reacts to Melo. Or just like put him in like a psychological experiment with like a one-way glass.
It's not on the, like, I don't know if I can actually tell the story, but, so I won't name names, but, like, I will say, like, I was sitting next to George Karl a couple of years ago at a summer league game, and one of his former Nuggets was playing and was not having a good game, and he was kind of joking about, like, yep, that's him, and it was a very, like, I think Karl would be a fun guy to really watch a game like that with, especially with one of his former players playing.
He would do that talking to the media, like,
yeah.
Off the record, he would do that, which a lot of coaches do, but the difference is kind of funny. So, I still think – I go back to what – I wrote about this after the whole Karl move happened. Gary Payton came out on Fox Sports and had like this rant where he was talking to DeMarcus Cousins and was like, if you trust him, he will make you into an all-star.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you – like, you have to believe – and I've always looked at that and been like, Gary Payton is one of the most prideful – stubborn, difficult guy. Like, he is an opinionated man. He is an opinionated
man. Very much so.
He is an opinionated man. And so for him, for all the snakes in the grass stuff, for him to sit there and say, you need to trust George Karl because he knows what he's doing, like, I really think that should go a longer way than it does. Like, everyone, you know, the snakes in the grass stuff everyone talks about, but I don't know. I just keep coming back to what coach has ever – there's only two ways to treat Melo. You either clash with him because he won't do what you want him to do, or you let him do whatever he does, and then you get fired because you don't win.
Yeah.
Like, that's – and Cousins, I think, is a little bit different in that, like, you mentioned in the post that he's a much more willing – like, he's a very willing passer.
Right, yeah, that's the thing. Like, he's one of the few big men who had a 20% assist rate last year, which is just – not like, I think there were like five other guys. Like, there was Noah, it was Blake Griffin, it was Josh Smith, it was Cousins, and then it was David West. Those are the only guys who had it. Like, and that's something where I think Karl talked about this when they came. Like, Karl took over and then they came to Miami last season, and he was talking a bunch. And before a game, and he kind of mentioned like the playmaker aspect for Cousins and stuff. And I do think, like, I don't think it's all on Cousins to you know, kind of give in to what George Karl wants. I think there has to be a balance. There has to be a middle ground, because I think Karl has to also recognize, like, which I'm sure he does. I mean, George Karl's a very smart guy, but George Karl can be stubborn. I think he has to recognize, like, I've got this monster. Like, there, like, DeMarcus Cousins is a monster who can just punish you. Like, just punish a defense in so many ways that we, you know, grew up glorifying and can still work today in that sense. And he's versatile. Like, he's a big man who can step out and hit a jumper. He can really move the rock. Like, he's a guy that can just do all these different things. And, you know, we talk about, like, adapting to your talent or adapting to your system and all this stuff. Like, he's one of those perfect guys where it's just like, if you can adapt your you know, tenets of basketball to, you know, a hybrid of what he's good at and what you're good at teaching, like, I do think, like, that's a really good relationship. It's just, it's been damaged so much at this point that you worry the first thing that goes wrong, will it fall apart? And I think that's the concern with Karl Cousins going forward, is, like, if both guys just realize, like, oh, we've got a job to do, let's do this, and kind of put that other stuff aside, which I think they'll try to do, but you can put it aside, and then as soon as something goes wrong, it can fall apart completely, right? Like, everything, like, bubbles back up to the surface. And I think that's more my concern moving forward. It's not like, oh, these guys can't get along. It's like, what happens when stuff gets tough for them? Will they revert back?
Karl made an interesting comparison when he was on Denver radio last week, because he's moving, so he did, like, the circuit. He compared the situation to what happened with Kenyon Martin, where he and Kmart's relationship was extremely fractured, and Karl went to Texas to meet with him and work out their differences. Because your article kind of illustrates this. There's no basketball reason that this can't work.
Right.
I think at its core, I really do believe that Melo and Karl were never going to work because of what Melo believes about himself, which I don't believe to be accurate, but it's what he believes. Cousins, I think, is a lot more flexible. He's a lot more, I think this will shock people, coachable on a basketball level. It's the personal stuff. It's Cousins' behavior. It's how he conducts himself. It's all of that. And he's maturing and changing, but there's also, like, a lot of it where if you talk to anybody, they're like, Cousins is still Cousins. Like, people have said, I've heard that from people in Sacramento. Like, Cousins is still Cousins. He's not, you know, there's more maturity, but it's also, and this is really difficult to find the nuance in, it's not a black and white thing. You don't wake up one day and are like, I'm mature and I treat everybody right the whole time and I conduct myself the right way all the time. It's, you have good days and bad days, and you have good moments and bad moments. And I think Karl really reacted last year to all the badness. A lot of that was, I think, impacted by how upset Cousins was over Malone being fired. And just, he didn't want to deal. He was like, I was sick and they fired the only coach we've had success with and you blew all this up and I'm just pissed. And that led to all the craziness this summer. But if they can start over from scratch, if they have started over from scratch, if they've cleared the deck and said, if Karl has gone and said, you are a superstar, you are going to be the guy, you are, like, you know, as long as Karl is like, I just want you to get offensive rebound. You know, as long as he respects the talent, which I think he obviously is smart enough to do, they can make the basketball stuff work. And then from there, it's a matter of Cousins not pushing the envelope too much on a personal level and Karl letting some stuff slide, which is hard for him. You know, and because I think that's where all the trade stuff came from, is he was just like, we don't have to put up with this. Like, he's not good enough to warrant this. I don't want to put up with this. Let's just get rid of him, and then if you trust me, like, we can win. Because I think that's – and there is – I will say there is a big part of this, and this is – Karl wants to win his way. He really wants to win his way.
That's where we get into, like, kind of that stubbornness aspect of it, right?
There's a philosophical aspect that goes even beyond, like, a pride thing to – I will never get over this. I asked Karl the week before that Warriors series in 2013 started. I did this long feature on him. And he stunned me. I threw him a softball and was like, would you rather win and compromise what you do or lose and keep what you believe is the right way to play basketball, which is fast, and play your style? That was a softball. Because, like, Any coach will say, I just want to win. Winning is what matters. That's why I play, you know, that's why I coach. That's what's the great part about being around sports is winning. And Carl said, I'd rather lose. And, like, I didn't know what to say for a second. And I thought to myself, you better beat the Warriors. Yeah, well.
And I think an important aspect, too, of this is it's not Carl Cousins, strictly. Like, that's not what's going to determine whether or not they're... It's all the other moves as well. Like, people freak out about this if you say this on Twitter because it's just not an idea that's accepted. Like, Rudy Gay's been really good on the Kings. Like, Rudy Gay has been really good as a Sacramento Kings player.
Yeah.
He's an excellent offensive player at this point. He's a really ideal stretch four. He's been really good. Now, should he be an all-star? No, he's not an all-star, but he's been a really good player. Like, you could do worse than having him as, like, your third guy. And as a team rebuilding, as the Kings are perpetually, like, you could do worse than having him as your second guy. Now, he still has to keep playing this way and keep improving and stuff, but he's actually, like, kind of brought himself back up to a level where he should be talked about the way he is. Or he shouldn't be talked about the way he is at this point. But so much of this, like, it's on Rudy Gay. It's on Rajon Rondo to prove that he's a good point guard again. It's on Darren Collison to find that balance. It's on Marco Bellinelli to be good. It's on Costa Cuvos to be a presence inside. It's on Willie Cauley-Stein to step forward as quickly as possible. Like, there's so many aspects. Like, Ben McLemore has to get better. It's like it'll get boiled down to, oh, Carl and Cousins worked or didn't work. But all of these other aspects with this team are what will make that team an elite offense and a threat in the West. It's not just, like, this relationship, it's everything. And I think that's an important thing to remember is, like, you have to get all these players to a certain point that they're capable of, but it's hard to get all those players to that point at the same time and be on the same page. Like that, and that's just the struggle with pro sports, and especially pro basketball. Like, there's a lot of pressure, there's a lot of money at stake, and there's a very finite amount of time in which you have to make it work. And so that accelerating that process, which is what the Kings have to do with so many new parts coming in, and this, you know, this madness around the team that they haven't been able to shake, or at least not yet, until they get on the court and actually show, you know, hopefully rewards of this whole process and situation. Like, it's hard to make all that work at the same time. That's why there's so few teams that are consistently good, right? Yeah. Is because that stuff just is ever changing.
I am a little worried about the locker room dynamics from the perspective of here's what I'm saying. What if Rudy Gay is like the swing vote?
Yeah.
Because Rondo, if there's not pressure from teammates for Rondo to do his job and act right and go along with the system and buy into what Carl's selling and do these things, Rondo's just going to do whatever he wants to do. Like, he showed that with the Mavericks.
Yeah.
He just did whatever he wanted to. Whatever he thought was best, he was going to do. And that can blow up. And then it's like, if you have... And if Rondo's doing that, Cousins isn't going to be like... Well, if he's not... Like, Cousins could be like, well, if he's not doing what he's supposed to, why do I have to? Like, I'm going to do what I want, too. And now you got chaos.
Yeah.
You know? So, like, maybe it really is, like, Rudy Gay being like, let's buy in... Because, you know, locker room leadership is a really complicated thing, and they are, like, they need those guys to kind of set the tone. And that's, Rudy Gay, DeMarcus Cousins, Rajon Rondo need to set the tone for that team. That's a scary thing to say.
Yeah, like, I think it's doable. I really think it's doable, but that's also, like, you know, Kings fans are a little fed up with everything at this point. And at a certain point, you have to say, like, You've got to see where people would question this, right? Like, I get why you think they're better, and I get why you think they'll compete for a playoff spot in the West. Like, I don't agree that they'll compete for a playoff spot in the West because I think the West is just too good. But, like, I get the idea that they're supposed to be, like, demonstratively better. I just think, like, you have to respect the fact that, like, there are legitimate questions of how this thing gets put together.
If the Kings were in the East, I would have them as, like, the 5 or 6 seed.
Right, exactly. Like, they would be, like, I would really be questioning myself, like, I don't know if the Bucks are better than the Kings. Like, you know, and that's, like, kind of crazy to say, but that's, you know, that would at least be the internal struggle I have, because in the East, this whole thing makes a ton of sense. But it's the Western Conference. Like, you have to be perfect. And you have to be lucky. You have to be crazy lucky.
Well, and it's just a matter of some of it's just schedule math, and you and I have talked about this a lot, where, you know, you can't afford to have those nights where you can't win if you don't play well in the West.
Right.
That's it. If you have those nights where we just didn't have it, like Rondo was distracted, or you know Cousins was out of gas, or whatever it is, like you're going to lose. You're going to lose in the Western Conference because you really have 10 to 11 teams that either are good or could be good. Maybe that's really where it's, and maybe 12. I mean, you go down the list. You got the 8 playoff teams from last year: OKC, Phoenix, and Utah. If you do not bring it against those teams, they will beat you more times than not. Unless you get on a lucky night where they also don't have it.
Yeah,
versus in the East, you can have a bad night and beat the Knicks. Like even with them being better this year, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing. It's great you get 4 games against the Lakers this season, but you get 8 games against the Clippers and Warriors. Like that just sucks.
Yeah.
Like that just sucks. Like,
and part of it is like they'll win some of these games and they'll compete against some of these good teams, but it's the consistency. Like that's where you get a good record. That's how you make the playoffs. That was Phoenix's problem. Is Phoenix would slip up in key situations in games where it was like you can't lose this game.
Yeah.
Like no matter what, like you got to win this one, and then they would drop it. And then they would be in a situation where it was like they would beat the Clippers or somebody and be like, we're back in it. It's like, you know, if you'd done both of those, you'd be in. Like, you'd be in a very solid spot. You have to have that consistency.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not like it was back in the early 2000s when you could just beat up on most of the league because it wasn't very strong. Like, you know, when Kobe and Shaq played together.
All right, we got to be careful because Shaq is a member of the media, right? But I will just say this. In entertainment consumption, they did a great job of marketing this Shaq podcast of like Kobe Bryant's going to be on it, and they're going to talk about their issues or whatever, and the issues they had, and the stuff that leaked out last week, like the little audio clips that leaked out, were great. I thought like really compelling stuff. Unfortunately, when I listened to the entire podcast yesterday, I could have just listened to those leaked clips and I would have been just as satisfied because I just felt like. It's an interesting thing with these two because I don't know if we're dumb for believing it or they're just really good salesmen, but these guys like really sell their side of the story and their existence within these workplace feuds or their, you know, where they are in the NBA or where they are in NBA history. Like they do a really good job of selling that, to the point where like we kind of just buy in. But I listened to that podcast yesterday, and I was just like, this seems like a story someone wants to sell me instead of wants to tell me, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And it's the idea of, like, I don't know. You rarely get the, oh, yeah, these guys today, like, they could, like, it's this idea of, oh, well, when I was good, everything was so much tougher and so much better. And, like, that's just a natural thing, right? Like, you and I are going to believe that the world we grew up in was tougher than the world our kids will grow up in because of, like, you know, convenience and technology and stuff. But with NBA players and pro athletes, like, it's always like, oh, it was so much tougher. We were so much more physical. We were so much stronger in my day. Where it's not actually true. So you get to the point of, like, is there another Kobe Bryant? Whether there's another Kobe Bryant in the league or not, is a different answer than, oh, well, this league is just so soft, everyone's friends now.
Yeah, that was a weird transition that he made.
Yeah.
It was like, do you think there's another Kobe Bryant? He was like, I don't know, man. Like, I grew up with, you know, when I came in the league, there was MJ and all these guys, and it's just so soft now. And he said the Olympics are more physical, which that's good for them. And
I mean, I don't plan it, so I can't argue with him necessarily. I watch it and I don't agree, but I'm also not playing in it. So
those are some mean 5'8 dudes, apparently. Just really physical 5'8 dudes. Yeah, so you mentioned like how like the clips were enough. That was one of the reasons I decided to do. I did 10 things to know about it yesterday. Part of it was just for the traffic and because we needed to have something up on it, and part of it was because I was like, if you don't want to sit through this 45-minute conversation, it's really just 20 minutes, honestly, of them. Just trying to play off everything and and with Shaq saying the same things over and over again. Here's like a guide to what kind of went on. I thought it was weird. My favorite exchange in the entire thing was when they addressed the rumor that Shaq had said to Kobe, "I'm going to murder you."
Right.
And how O'Neal was, Shaq was like, "Well, yeah, but I didn't mean it." And my favorite part of that was Kobe's response, which was, "I just said, bring it on."
Yeah.
Like, come on, then.
I do, like, that's the part of their relationship that I find fascinating, that I really enjoy. I was a little surprised, like, just how, even on Inside the NBA, like, Shaq is so, not like a bully, but he's so, like, remember how strong and tough I am and how great I was kind of deal. And he almost seemed, not to bend, but, like, it was just a very soft side of Shaq. Not to say he's soft, but, like, just a much softer side than I expected with Shaq throughout the entire thing as he was referring to Kobe. Like, you could tell there was, like, a legitimate respect that really made him, like, make sure, like, hey, I want you guys to know, I love this guy. I recognize the talent, I recognize the decisions he made and why he made them all. Like, that's not something necessarily I expected, but, like, hearing back of how they thought at the time, that's the thing I found interesting from the interview. But the rest of it just kind of seemed like two friends trying to pump each other up, which is fine. Like, it's just not what I was expecting. So maybe it's my expectations.
Yeah, and you referred to it as, like, a workplace beef, which made some sense. I mean, it was pretty personal, though. Like, it's hard to get – you listen to the comments that they had and how they – and the things that Kobe would say about him in terms of his conditioning and everything else. And
I do think, like, heat-of-the-moment stuff does matter, but it can't just be an excuse for everything, right?
Yeah. Like, I'm having a hard time imagining a situation in which two people can work together and you say either I go or he goes and it's not personal. That to me is kind of difficult to see.
Yeah.
You know?
I love the stories, though, about, like, young Kobe being overly confident and cocky and everything. Like, I love that
stuff. Half MJ and scoring. And
yeah. Like, that was stuff, like, I want more stories about that. Or more stories about in the moment, like, you guys lose to Detroit in 2004. Like, I want to know what you were thinking at that point.
Yeah, it would have been nice to hear them talk about the adversity, which they didn't. And I think that was part of it for them. And when they look back on it, is they look back and they're just like, we were just so dominant. And part of that to me is, I just get back to them like, yeah, you were dominant. You're playing against Kerry Kittles.
There was one highlight in there, like one audio clip highlight that really made me laugh, where it was like, Todd McCullough inside, Shaq blocks the shot. Like, Todd McCullough? You couldn't at least, like, find him blocking Dikembe Mutombo in the audio clip?
I mean, and I know everyone looks to the everyone points to the Kings team and that Blazers team, and those are two very good teams. But we really don't talk about the rest of even their conference at the time as being particularly strong.
Well, even those Mavericks teams were good, but they weren't that good.
Yeah,
right. Like, before they really got things. Like, that team was always a threat, just because you had to be weary of their offense. Like, the Steve Nash, Michael Finley, Dirk Nowitzki combination was really, really good, but it was also very much these guys don't really play defense. We should be fine.
Yeah. And maybe I'm just a prisoner of the moment. I just look at the league now and I'm like, there are so many good teams, and everyone says, yeah, well, what are they going to do against Shaq? And I was like, well, nothing. Shaq's going to do what he did then, which is not, like, no one stopped him. You know, like, what does it matter? Like, who was going to stop him? Who stopped him then? No one stopped him.
Right.
When there were seven-footers, no one stopped him. But if you're talking about Rick Fox having to guard, like, LeBron, how's that going to work out?
It's a little, like, harder.
You know, I'm trying to think of some of those other teams. Some of the other guys on those squads, like, here, I'm looking at the
2000. Well, I mean, perfect example, 2001 to 2004, the Timberwolves were a pretty successful team, at least regular season.
Yeah.
Like, Trent Hassel was, like, their third or fourth best player every year. Like, they weren't really that good. Kevin Garnett was good. The rest of the team sucked.
Samaki Walker played 69 games in the 2002 Lakers.
Sure, why not?
I'm just trying to, even if you got Kobe, right, and they're to play, let's say, the Clippers now, right? You're going to put Kobe on Chris Paul. Okay. So Derek Fisher's running around trying to chase J.J. Redick. And Robert O'Reilly's having to check Blake Griffin. Is that what the plan is?
And then, the response is like, yeah, well, DeAndre Jordan can't handle Shaq. But like you said, like, no one could handle Shaq.
Yeah.
That was always the funny thing to me. People are like, oh, Shaq wasn't so big. And like, well, he is, so deal with it.
Or like the Spurs now? Like, Tim Duncan's just going to go out to 16 feet, and Shaq's not going to guard him, and Tim Duncan's going to score 35 points shooting mid-range bank shots.
Yeah.
Like, that's just what's going to happen. So I'm not trying to take away how good those teams were. They were really good. They won three titles.
Well, that's always the tough thing about, like, comparing eras, right? Is like everything has its own context to the moment, and so the Lakers dominated that era. It doesn't mean they couldn't win championships in other eras, but I think that there's a big difference, and their experience dominating helps set up the advancement that we have today, yeah. Right? Because then you have to figure out how to beat it, and you have to get smarter in basketball. Like all of those stepping stones, like the Celtics of the 50s, 60s. I guess partly 70s too, like the Lakers and Celtics of the 80s, the Bulls and Rockets in the 90s, the Spurs, the Lakers, like all that stuff builds up to the point where we are now, where the league is so good and all these teams are so good, except for the Timberwolves and the Sixers, but all those other teams are still so good, and like all these situations happen where it's like everything is a stepping stone and a building block to the next era of basketball, and that's why it's always better, because you have to learn from the stuff of the past and find a way to get ahead in the future.
So speaking of the past, to wrap things up, you want to talk a little bit about the great Wes Craven?
Wes Craven passed away, which was like, passed away at 76 years old, which was kind of like one of those, it's not that I actively thought about Wes Craven every day, but like when you find out he's passed away, you're just like, wow, he really had an effect on my like childhood and my life, like enjoying movies and stuff, and you just kind of like he had some paycheck movies, like the Freddy vs. Jason stuff wasn't great, but like I watched Nightmare on Elm Street 1,000 times as a child, like I would sneak in and find it and watch it, looking back, wildly inappropriate for me to watch that stuff at the time, but like it was something where to me it was funny, and I didn't get the stuff that I wasn't supposed to get anyway, and so it kind of, as stuff goes on, like as life goes on, you realize like how much more depth there is to the things you enjoyed. But like Nightmare on Elm Street, I was a huge Swamp Thing fan. I love The Hills Have Eyes. Like he did so many things for horror movies, which was a genre like I just attached to early on. I like being scared. I like getting caught up in the moment. He added humor to it. Like Wes Craven just did a lot of stuff that was great. And he kind of reinvented it too when he brought in Scream and found way. Like it wasn't just like, oh, gore, gore, gore. It was like, it became like the psychological thriller again was in vogue. Like maybe he didn't create that, but he kind of brought it back to being like something in vogue.
The Nightmare on Elm Street series was, it really was, it's hard to kind of put it in context now because things have gotten so crazy gory,
yeah,
and intense, but those movies were terrifying when I was a kid. Just so many of the sequences were really intense. The Hills Have Eyes is an insanely terrifying concept.
It really is.
Mutant things. It's funny you mentioned Swamp Thing. I love Swamp Thing.
I had toys. Like, I had all that stuff.
I love Swamp Thing. Everyone talks about how bad it was. I was like, I really enjoyed it.
Let me tell you, 8-year-old me was all about Swamp Thing.
Where the bathtub fills up and he comes out.
Yeah. And even so, like, I don't know if you've seen Shocker. Late 80s horror movie. Basically, this guy gets convicted of murder. They electrocute him, and he just like enters the electrical system,
right?
For getting the electrical chair, and then he's just like trying to. I think he's trying to kill like the victim's son or something like, or a witness or something like that. And it's just him like, oh, there's an outlet. I'm gonna pop out and try to kill you. Like that's all it is. But like even movies like that were great. He directed Vampire in Brooklyn, which I love.
Yes,
Vampire in Brooklyn.
Yes.
He did The People Under the Stairs. Like, he just did a lot of stuff. Even a newer movie, Red Eye. Red Eye is kind of like a great like 80-minute like just experience.
Scream was such a huge deal too.
Yeah, Scream became like kind of a joke and cartoonish, and then a parody. But like the original Scream, like that first movie in what was it, like 95 or whatever, 96, like he, like that was like, that was brilliant. It was a brilliant horror movie.
Sorry, I'm just laughing because Scream came out in 96 and Scream 2 came out in 97.
I feel very different about those two movies.
Like they cashed in on that hard.
Real quick.
Man, Skeet Ulrich, Rose McGowan, Matthew Lillard.
Nev Campbell.
David Arquette has a song on the Scream 2 soundtrack, by the way.
you tweeted me the Scream 2 soundtrack. I forgot that masterpiece song existed.
That masterpiece. My favorite is the Cottonmouth Kings song. The Cottonmouth Kings, who were a thing. It was tremendous. Nev Campbell. It's crazy just because Nev Campbell should have been a megastar.
Yeah.
And Drew Barrymore went on to be such a big deal.
That's the thing. Like, Drew Barrymore was a big deal then, but, yeah. Like, to have a movie where she gets, spoiler alert, she gets killed off in the first scene, like, that way, like, even that kind of thing of, like, here's this star, by the way, she's gone.
Yeah, and she's just dead, yeah.
Yeah.
Courtney Cox is great in that movie, too.
Yeah. Really unlikable, which was the point.
Really unlikable, which was, she's really good at doing it, but I think people had questions after, like, with her coming off of Friends, it was like, can she really be unlikable? And, oh, yeah.
Very much so.
She's very, very hateable. Last House on the Left, also.
Oh, excellent.
I can't even handle Last House on the Left.
It's, that's like one, like, it's like, it's almost like, I mean, it's kind of like the perfect revenge movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, very, that one's a little tough to get through. And then just like, even, all right, there is a limit, like probably around, Nightmare on Elm Street 4, you're like, wow, this is maybe pushing it, but like, I don't know, I'll cape for the first three all day.
Well, I don't think he did.
He wrote them. He's like credited as a writer. I don't know if he exclusively wrote them, but like he's credited as a writer, but he didn't direct them.
I enjoy Dream Warriors though.
Yeah,
Dream Warriors. I really like great. Dream Warriors. The boxes for the VHS cassettes to rent of Nightmare on Elm Street series were always really like terrifying and yet really cool to look at.
And he was just like very influential on where things went. Like there are a lot of scary movies out there now that are not as cartoonish, you know, that are kind of more in that psychological thriller thing that he really, you know, kind of made a thing again.
Well, Scream was also interesting in that it wasn't supernatural.
Right.
And there are very few films that throughout horror history, like Psycho is, I think, the standard.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's very difficult to find horror films that really reach the pantheon.
Right.
That aren't based in the supernatural. And that was, I think, one of the really impressive things. And the other thing was, like, he made horror cool, which was, at the time, I think, very difficult because people were so worn out with the Freddy and Jason stuff. They were so worn out.
It wasn't a new genre. It was just here, like, let's take it this way now. Like, let's make this scary kind of deal.
Yeah. And to me, The Ring stands out as another film that kind of shifted.
Yeah.
The horror dynamic, because to me, there's like a direct line between The Ring and Paranormal Activity. And then have like, the thing involved the screen and all those things. And I think the Blair Witch Project obviously influenced the Paranormal series as well. Is the new Poltergeist out?
I don't believe so, but I
want to see it.
I have no idea.
I kind of want to see it.
Horror
is interesting in that you don't find anybody that just says, like, I don't like action movies. They'll say, I don't like superhero movies, or I don't like, you know, war movies, but you don't find anybody that says, I don't like action movies. Nobody's going to say, like, I don't like comedy. Like, laughing, not for me. Just not what I do. But it's, horror really is one of those things that either you can watch it or you cannot.
Well, that's the thing, too. Like, I don't know if I'm annoying or entertaining to watch a horror movie with, but, like, I really kind of allow myself to jump and get scared. Like, I it's an exhilarating adrenaline thing. And it's fun, like, but there's some people who really hate that feeling.
My wife.
But, yeah.
Like, no. Like, she's like, she is a no, hard no, not a, cause like a lot of people are like, oh, I can't handle it. And they just, you know, obviously when you're in high school, it's like the girls like want to go to the horror movie so they can hide in the boyfriend. And it's like an excuse to make out. Like, that's just what you do. And my wife is like, I have zero interest in watching this with or without you. I do not care. Like, no, we are not watching this scene at all.
Yeah, so just, I'm going to miss him. I'm going to miss that influence, and I hope there are other people who can kind of keep that going on.
Patricia Arquette's first appearance was Dream Warriors. That was her first role.
Okay. And now look at her.
And that was in 87, and then she was in True Romance, which I consider to be her best performance in 93.
She's famous because her sister was in Nowhere to Run with Jean-Claude Van Damme. That's why she's famous. Nowhere to Run's like one of the best Van Damme movies. I don't understand why it doesn't get up there with everything else.
I'm the only one that thinks this. Cyborg is the best to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'll go Bloodsport, but
I like Bloodsport.
Yeah.
I love Cyborg. I love everything about Cyborg.
Cyborg's great.
I do not like Universal Soldier.
Whoa.
I'm sorry. Can't
Let's
get into
not
it.
Say things we're going to regret.
Although, there's like a direct line between Universal Soldier and the Expendables. Like, that was the first, like, super mega team-up.
Yeah.
Of those guys.
Yeah, Dolph versus Jean-Claude was a big deal.
What do you think? What was the terrible Cyborg movie that Lundgren was in?
Universal Soldier 3?
what is it? I Come in Peace.
That's really bad.
I Come in Peace.
That's an atrocious movie.
When I was when it came out, I was 90, so I was 8. When I was 8, we lived on a farm, and on this farm we had a satellite dish that had just been left there, and my dad bribed a guy, because there were so few satellites at this time in 1990, my dad bribed the satellite guy from one of the towns to set us up, and he hooked us up with free pay-per-view. And so I come in, there's these movies that just played over and over and over again, and so like that was one of the ones, and that one and B.I. Warshawski are the two movies that I remember the most from that time period.
Wow.
Kathleen Turner, man.
I remember just, what was the movie, Stay Tuned? With
yes!
That was one where I was just, I realized, like, satellite TV was the future.
That was where I knew.
That's when I knew. Like, yeah, this cable thing's good, but satellite TV is where it's at.
Alright, good pod.
Good pod, Matt. Read your Rockets thing on CBSSports.com. Read my Mello Cousins Carl deal on CBSSports.com, and I will talk to you later.
Thanks, man.